You're listening to Red Setter, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Welcome to this week's Red Setter. I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jason Wingrave. How are you, Mike?
Good. This week we got some really interesting discussions. In the area of cinematography and digital cinematography, we've discussed a lot of studio situations and a lot of other interesting technical aspects. One of the things we've really not covered, I think, is some of the rigors of field work. In other words, shooting on location and shooting in the field. And I guess, Jace, today in the Red Room, we have somebody that knows more about the rugged conditions of shooting in the field than almost anyone we've ever spoken to.
Yeah, we've a good mate and a keen Twitterer. First Lieutenant Tyler Ginter from the 55th Combat Camera Company. He's essentially in charge of implementing and training and getting out there in the field with the U.S. Army, shooting on the ground. And he's got some great stories about training guys and, some cool stories. Good guy.
And, in fact, that story focuses primarily around the work that they've been doing recently with the Canon 5D Mark II, which I think is really fascinating, but from a video perspective primarily. Of course, that we're interested in. Well, I call it video, but digital cinematography is what I should call it.
Yeah, well, hence the change to what you probably noticed at the beginning of the show, our new intro. Not just your place for Red Center, Red Camera News, but obviously we're now broadening our horizons, talking about digital cinema, cinematography in general, and obviously still keep the general filmmaking rat holes. We'll still keep rat holes firm friends.
And to that end, I think the area of moving from the stills camera to shooting video in the case of Canon is very Red relevant, given that Red's roadmap is to go from shooting 4K digital cinematography to expanding out to covering still photography as well as very, very high-end still photography in the form of the 617 and the vast panoramic high-resolution stuff. So I think this entire convergence area is something that we're keen to look at, both from a cinematography point of view and also from a post-production workflow point of view. But more of that coming up later in the show. Jason, let's start out the show by just having a quick chat about what we've seen news-wise around the traps.
And now, the Red Setter News.
Yeah, okay. By the time it's literally been announced, it's actually been filled and done and sorted. But essentially, Jim on Red User put out a shout out for people who wanted to be, I guess, beta testers for a new version of Red Color Science. Mike, do you know what Red Color Science is?
This is basically a new version of Red Space, and it's the Red Color.
Just when
science.
We covered it and we got it sorted, and we.
Well, no, we need something else to talk about. This is being led by Graham, and Graham Natras is doing this with a group that was literally volunteered themselves within 15 minutes of the post going up. So we look forward to seeing whatever that yields. But certainly, there was a version of Red stuff that came out a little while ago, and we saw a sneak preview of it, and it was not actually in the release. So perhaps that's going to resurface. But we'll wait this time until it's released before we talk about it.
Okay, but at the end of this testing, I guess, what looks like it will have a new firmware for the camera and a new version of Red Alert,
yep.
I guess.
And then for a new version of the SDK and a new, perhaps a new version of what we call Red Space as we now see it.
Okay.
So, Jace, the other thing that was sad to hear is that someone nicked another Red, the bastard.
Yes, Red Camera 0714 was stolen in Seattle on the 21st of May. Stolen from a car outside a restaurant, it's kind of, you'd have to say, duh, don't leave gear in the car. But, I can kind of see what they're doing. You wrap, you've got to, everyone says, oh, come and have a bite, you're tired. You hide it in the car somewhere, bury it under something, and you just sod's law. It's that car park that night that the thieves go rummaging from car to car looking for whatever. They don't know what they've got. They don't know what the hell a red one is.
At least that's what you're assuming, unless you know these people. I personally think it was someone that was just in the queue saying, I want to get a leg up on getting a cheap new Epic, and figured that I'd...
Right.
Buy a camera, but we're too stupid to understand that every single frame of footage shot with a camera is encoded with the serial number of the camera.
Yeah.
And so it really is of no use to anyone.
Exactly.
So
it'll be no good to trade in. As you say, any piece of footage that shows up with that metadata is going to have a bit of a ping. Red, obviously, themselves have a hot list, so they've got it as marked as stolen within their database. So if anybody wants to get it serviced, you know, anything goes wrong with the camera, that's going to, you know, a bit of a red flag is going to show up there, so you're kind of screwed. So look, it was, so it's Red 714, had a red LCD, steel rails, a red cradle, top handle, and Nikon 50mm prime. So, look, if it shows up on Craigslist or eBay or a pawn shop or anywhere near you, if you see a pawn shop sitting there, if you see a red one sitting next to the old...
Guitar amps
and the Super 8 cameras, you need to get on to ericdinnell at gmail.com. So that's erik.dinnell@gmail.com. And give him a ping. I'm sure he'd be keen to hear if you've heard anything. One of the little things that sort of came in, sort of Red User was sort of going on about people having issues with Red drives and some mounting on some camera on some laptops and not mounting on some laptops. It would mount on an older MacBook Pro, but not on a new one. And one of the sort of gotchas that came out of this is that ideally, do not plug the drive straight into FireWire ports without using the power supply for the drive, right, Mike?
Well, this is kind of news to me. Like, I think that, I just find that quite extraordinary. Like, the whole point of the darn drives is you unplug them, walk over and plug them into a laptop. Since when do we have to plug them in with power at a laptop?
Well,
I was like, what? You what?
Well, exactly. I mean, essentially, they should just be bus powered. But the theory, I think, the best practice is to power it up with the power supply before you plug it in. I mean, people say, "Oh, you're going to blow up your FireWire ports," but essentially, what it does, I think, it just kind of trips them out, and then you have to do like a PMU. You have to do like a reset on the laptop to then get the FireWire ports to come back again. I've never heard of it, but it's a gotcha, so it's out there.
Well, but
so.
Is it an official gotcha, or is it just somebody saying that they think that's the case?
This is I'm not sure it's an official gotcha. It's not a post that's been backed up or supported by, I think, by anyone from Red. But this just seems to be anecdotal that if you are having issues mounting these drives, maybe it can come down to a bus powering issue. And if for some reason that the drive won't mount, it'll probably be because, you know, you're not getting sufficient power through your particular laptop's particular FireWire port.
Yeah, but straining the FireWire ports for power is one problem, right? That's a completely different issue to this is going to wreck your Red drive.
No, I don't think there's any issues with the drive.
That doesn't hurt the Red drive.
No, this is just a potential issue with your FireWire ports on your laptop.
I'm jury's out on that one. I'm sorry, dude. I'm like I'm flagging that as like I'm not buying that.
Okay. All right. Well, look. Theoretically, let's hear otherwise from other people out there. But best practice theoretically is power up the drive as well as.
I just don't want to do that. Forward.
No, I know absolutely. I wouldn't have thought to do it either. I've seen it a trillion times on set being plugged up the normal way, as you say, getting bus power through FireWire. But, you know, if you are having an issue and something's not mounting, try putting the power supply in. If it works, then great.
Yeah, not buying it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
All righty. Well, if you've got the word, if you know what that is, give us a buzz back.
Ted, if you're listening, please call. and you know why I'm saying Ted. Okay, so on unrelated Red news on...
But still rather huge news.
Huge news is this much talked about, much rumoured and now confirmed firmware update
for the 5D
EOS 5D Mark II, yes.
Indeed. Yeah, well, obviously what everyone's been clamouring for with this camera.
Well, almost what everyone's been clamouring for.
Well, one of the things has been the ability to have manual control of your shutter speed, manual control of your ISO, and manual iris, basically. There's been a lot of workaround and hacks and sticking gaffer tape on lens contacts and pointing it up to bright light, and you know, it's just crazy hacks going on to be able to use this thing and have some modicum of control over the iris. So Canon have listened in some degree, at least anyway, and on I think June 2 they will release a firmware update that will give you manual exposure of the ISO, aperture, and shutter speed, which will be just awesome. And I think that sort of that's taking it some way towards being a usable camera. I think it undoes a lot of the fucked upness of it, and basically the next step will be getting 24p or 25p.
So you want to take a bet on whether or not they can do 24p on the current camera, or whether we have to wait for a EOS 5D Mark II XL version or something?
Yeah, my bet is if they could do it, they would have done it, I reckon. I think my guess is maybe you'll have to send it back. I don't know. Maybe to get a hardware update, or maybe you will have to wait for the 5D Mark III. My guess, having seen the 90% of the noise back to Canon would have been 50% for the manual control and 50% give us 24p. so if they've done all of this but left the 24p out, 25p out, then clearly they couldn't do it. Why not just wait a week and do it all? So there must be some issue with being able to do it. What I understand, if you can do 30p, why can't you do 25p? It's less.
Well,
we're not asking a 25p camera to go to 30 frames.
Yeah, okay, so this isn't a continuum. This isn't like you've got any number between 0 and 100.
Mm.
This is like there's a clocking speed and a rate at which the sensor is able to be. And if that's just in ASIC design, 30, saying it's less is a bit like saying, well, I was trying to think of a good analogy here.
Well, it's like clocking it's, your...
it's like saying you've got a four-seater car. I'd only like two people in it. So can you just move it up so that there's more room for the two seats and less room for the back seat? And you're like, well, yeah, if I get in there with an acetylene torch and take out the back seat, but it's designed for four seats.
Two seats
is less. Surely it's easier to just have two seats. Well, yeah, except for it's already built with four.
Yeah, we can do it, but you will put the seats in the middle, but then you won't be able to reach the steering wheel. And
I think you're right. I think if they could have done it, they would have. But I also think that in all seriousness, if I had to pick between the two, and certain people like Stu will hate me saying this, but if I had to pick between the two, if I had to pick which of these I'd like to see go first between the 24 and the manual, I'd have picked manual.
Yeah, because definitely.
While I totally agree that you need 24, boy, do I agree that, especially if you're like me and we shoot everything 24, the manual thing really screws up your ability to make it look right.
Yeah, that's what they were trying to achieve. That the whole depth of field thing is about trying to achieve this filmic look. And I've seen some gorgeous images. I mean, I've seen some fantastic images. I haven't seen anything that's really screwed up by the 24, 25, 30p thing. I've seen more footage screwed up just by sort of horrible motion blur that just makes it, you know, all the effort of trying to get this gorgeous imagery just go out the window.
I agree. That's one I'd have picked.
Yep, two right. No, look, I mean, this is fantastic, and maybe someone will come up with a workaround, but as you say, essentially, you can't just drop 5 frames every second and just get away with it.
It is actually a really hard problem to go from 30 to 24 if you're shooting progressively.
Yeah. I'll take everyone's word for it. No one has really been able to say there's been a great workaround yet, and I can't see that there will be, is there?
No. I mean, it's a standards conversion, right? In the classic sense of, here I have a tape and I'd like you to do a standards conversion. And standards conversion is the same technology that leads to optical flow analysis and a whole bunch of other stuff. And doing it like for an NTSC master that you want to come back, used to be taking advantage of the fact that it was interlaced and not progressive, and in the sense that you could, play with fields a bit. But even that, if you're lucky, we used to get 30 frame footage and you'd go, okay, well, this was built from 24.
Yeah.
So we'd then take it out and that would get us back to 24. And then from 24, we'd get to 25. If you had to pick of all the permutations, from 24 to 25, from 25 to 30, actually going, we used to say in standards conversion, going from 30 to 25 was the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
But anyway, it isn't easy. And it's certainly not the case that there's some piece of software that you could just buy or that someone's likely to invent in the next few minutes on their iPhone.
But they just haven't thought about it. I mean, if you can take 24 or 25 easily and make it to 30, I mean, they do that all the time. Most movies are shot on 24 frames a second, right?
Yeah, so you had 3:2 pull down to get from 24 to 30.
Yeah, so it's easy to go that direction, but a pain to go the other way. So, I mean, I think, as we've said before, I think it's one of those things that this is really, even though Canon designed this camera to really be like the Reuters cam or to be, you know, the photojournalist sort of camera, I think they haven't really have not...
But for a photojournalist, right, it's perfect because a photojournalist wants to go out 30 because they want to just put out news and they don't want to put out interlace.
Yeah.
Because when you go from 24 to 30 using 3-2 pull-down, you get ugly 3-2 pull-down artifacts, yeah. Which... quite frankly, the cinematographer likes because it makes it look filmic.
Yeah.
But the news camera guy who's used to shooting field-based 60 frames a second kind of stuff. Yeah. But my argument would be if it's like I think it's hard to come up with an argument as to why the news reporter wants 30, except for the fact that actually it's less data. And so if I was in some remote location and trying to send back footage from Bosnia, if I could send back 24 frames a second instead of 30, I'd actually be sending back, you know, significantly less data.
Yeah.
If it was going to take an hour, it would only take, you know, 45 minutes to upload kind of thing.
But if you're trying to get an edit straight into a news feed really quick, I guess somewhere along the line you have to convert it. You have to convert it to 30, right?
Exactly. At some point you have to do that.
That's a bit hard. I don't work in the NTSC world, so...
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the 30 frame a second solution is not a dumb solution if I'm going to be filming, I don't know, something presidential that is happening on the lawn and that somebody's going to, you know, come out with the dog and there you go. There's nothing wrong with that, right? It will look good. It just doesn't look filmic. But more to the point, it really screws you up if you really want 24 frames for projecting in cinema because getting it a cleanly... See, the thing about it is 24 to 30 adds 3-2 pull-down, which in a video world... You either, if you're like me, you don't like, or if you're somebody that's used to it in America, you think it looks cinematic. But no one likes fields when projected on a film screen.
Yeah.
So when you go back to 24, if you start playing with fields, you literally project up little jaggy lines and fieldy artifacts. So that's just not a viable solution at all.
So 3-2 pull down, forgive me, because I've never, again, don't really have to do it in my game anyway. That's, you're actually doubling frames.
No, it's pretty simple, really. You used to shoot video, right? And the video was a frame, was the A and the B
fields,
and then A and B, and then A and B, right? And the thing about A and B is that they would actually happen one after another. So you would, if a ball was flying through the air, it exposed where it was at A, then it exposed where it was at B, and the ball had moved, right? So when you play it back, you actually get really smooth motion because there doesn't seem to be... as much staccato and a sort of short shutteriness to it. Now, that's fine, and you do that, and you're shooting 60 fields, and you're happy. And then you say, well, I want to shoot progressive because it looks more like film, because film obviously shoots 24 frames a second, and inherently it shoots progressively. So now you've got some film at 24, which is Lawrence of Arabia. You've got NBC that's going out as 3-2 pull down, or there's 30 frames a second with two fields, which means 60. So how do I get from 24 to 60? I say, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll do something like this. I'm going to go A field and the B field. Then I'll go on the next frame, I'll take the A field again, but the B field of the frame after, and then the B field and then the A field. And so you basically build up this sort of mixing of fields. So instead of having frame repeating, you get a partial frame repeat, partially the next frame, and it cycles. And this A-B-A-B pattern is something that cycles. And so you get...
Because if you've got a cinema print, right, at 24 frames...
Well, now that's a disaster because you can't... If you print fields where half the picture horizontally is happening at one instant in time, you can't then also put up a frame simultaneously with it in the same place. In other words, imagine if you, like, got a video frame and froze it. That's what you're putting out to film. So if the ball was a bit different in the frame... Okay, I'm going to explain this now. Literally, the field sequence goes DD, CD, CB, BB, AA. So if you had four frames that were D, C, B, A, which is four frames, it turns into five frames by going... The first two fields of D, then D and C, so this is a makeup frame stolen from half of D and half of C, then you steal half of C and half of B, then you get all of B, all of A, and it repeats, right? It's called 3-2 pull down. It's just ugly, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now you've got that pattern. That's what you get, and you have to remove it. And you can do that and get back to 24 because you know the logic, and it's logical and it repeats. But if you were to put that out to film, when you've got that DC one or the CB one,
blended.
Literally half your image horizontally is like a little to the left and half it's a little to the right on a per line basis. So the image, you actually see the lines. It looks like complete bollocks. It doesn't look like that on the TV screen because it's still kind of, when it's playing, it's still
the scan line fields. One is from the frame before and scan line one.
So it's like you're going DD, you're going DD, DC, CB, BB, AA.
Yeah.
At least they're all sort of like one happens after the other. But on a film camera, you sort of snapshot the D, which looks okay, but you snapshot DC, looks horrible.
Yeah.
CB looks horrible. BB looks good, and AA looks horrible, and it starts over again. And it's just, yeah. But more than that, it's just about if you want to look cinematic, you shoot 24 frames a second.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I just had that major battle on a shoot last month where we're literally about to roll, and we're saying, no, they said, no, it's got to be 30 frames, saying, are you really sure? Do I really have to shoot 30 frames on film? Because, you know, obviously, shooting 30 frames, apart from anything, that's another whatever, 10 whatever percent of film costs.
Well, yeah. And also, if you're doing roto, I can tell you, you must refer to roto 24 frames than 36, than 30 frames.
Yeah. Well, we that didn't have to do anything, frames. But basically, I mean, what I was most concerned about at the other end, making it look correct. If every, you know, I'm sure that every, you know, as we later found out, I was being told by someone who did not know, to shoot this at 30 frames when every single, virtually every single commercial over there, you know, is shot 24.
Yeah. I mean, it saves 25% of the stock and processing and everything else under the sun, but absolutely. It also looks cinematic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So now eventually we found on the phone just before about this yell action, eventually found the right person to say, yeah, go 24, which I'd confirmed with many a Twitter person, thank you very much, at the time. Yeah, so it was kind of stupid. So then obviously to get from 24 to 30, you have to do, obviously you're not dealing with fields, you're dealing with frames, so there has to be some frame blending to get out to
from 24 to 30, But that even that process, if I watch my red footage shot at 24 frames a second played on a 30 frame with 3-2 pull down added, it looks as cinematic as Raiders of the Lost Ark does when they did exactly the same thing and shot 24 frames on film and then transferred it to 30. And so if your eye is tuned to an American screen, you go, that looks normal.
Yeah.
If you're an Australian, you go differently, because in Australia, you're PAL, so we go, well, we're shooting 24, we'll do a 4% speed change, get it to 25, and watch it that way, which means for the nut jobs that hopefully listen to this show, I have a friend who's an editor, and he will only buy the NTSC, when before we had HD, he'd only buy the NTSC copy of a film.
Right, yeah.
Because if the editor decided that in the pacing of the film, that shot should hold for 2 seconds,
right?
Yep. When they did that in PAL, there'd be a 4% speed change.
Mm.
And his thing was, well, that isn't the interpretation of the editor. The editor doesn't want 4% speed up on the work. That wasn't the pacing that they did it. And he has so much respect for editors, he'd only buy the NTSC copy, which a second is a second, and the film lasts the right duration.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, here we shoot 25 frames because we're going to, for PAL, we'll shoot 25 frames and obviously you'll stay 25 frames the whole way through.
Yeah, but if you're shooting a feature in Australia, you'd shoot 24.
24, absolutely, absolutely.
Edit at 25, 24 in Avid.
So if you want to give your PAL commercial a really cool American film look, you should shoot 24, convert to 23, convert to 30 frames a second, and then do that slowdown.
Well, no, Jace, because what you do to slow the slowdown is you remove the 3-2 pull down you added, get you back to 24.
Yeah, but there's something in there. There's something in that process, I reckon, that just adds that little. Sometimes you can see, you know, if you're watching a chain of commercials, you can see the difference between a locally shot commercial and either something that they've taken from overseas, or you can see a difference between the commercial and the beginning of, you know,
but next commercial episode of 24. Is very unlikely to be shot 24 in Australia, right?
No, that's right, sure.
So that's not going to have any fielding artifacts whatsoever.
Yeah.
Where the American one was shot either 24 or whatever, but does have fields no matter what, because there's going to be something happening to it.
Yeah, but if you want to give it to, and what I'm saying, I guess you need some sort of standards conversion from what would probably, if they were bringing in an episode of 24, to here.
You'd
have a 30.
Because they shoot and do HD.
Yeah.
And that's why you have 24 as the ultimate, or 23.98 as the ultimate HD standard. This is a heck of a rat hole. because you want to
We're talking about a film, a series called 24, and we're talking about 23.98 converting to...
But the show 24, well, let's talk about the show ER, which shot on the red camera. They would shoot that at 24 because apart from anything else, it's a great format to support selling it to Britain and Australia and to the American audience because 24 to 25 is easy, 24 to 30 is easy, everybody's happy, one master, thanks for playing.
Yeah.
You just don't have video cameras like a Digi Beta that shoots 24 frames a second, so they never did that in the old days.
Right, yeah, of course, now you do, but yeah.
Fortunately, we can do that today.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, no, there's an elusive little step in there somewhere that makes what I see from the States here look different too.
Well, the other big problem, okay, now we're just really going off here, but the other problem is if it's standard def, there aren't enough lines on the American one because they shoot a higher frame rate but have less lines. We have more lines here.
We do.
Now, if you're shooting and mastering in HD, it's 1920 by 1080, both cases. But if you shot and mastered in NTSC, not only are you 30 frames a second, but you actually don't have enough actual lines.
Yeah. So you're scaling it up. You're upscaling it to PAL.
Because we're 720 by 576 here.
Yeah.
And they have some 400 and something number for American lines.
Mm.
So that's a whole second issue. So you've got what we like to say in the geeky world that I live in, temporal and spatial issues to be solved.
I'm sure there's plenty in the world you live in.
The question is, could we come up with a really cool spark that would sort of solve this, that would give you, or a plug-in, or something that would give you the ultimate American film look for your for your work?
Well, it's somehow, in a way, you know, there's a little subconscious thing when you're watching the difference, you know, the audience can tell, I can tell, you know, it's a little subconscious difference between, you know, a TV show, come from the States or wherever, and the TV commercial. They always just look like commercials before anyone's even opened their mouth. You just go, yeah, that was a commercial.
Yeah.
I don't know,
the one that I think's really funny is when you go to cinemas and they digitally project with a lower quality video projector the cinema TV commercials, yes. And then it cuts to the real film. And last night I was at the Terminator 4 preview.
Yeah.
Okay, and we saw the preview for Plenum 123.
Plenum 123, yep.
Okay, so I saw that projected film. Great trailer.
Yeah.
Last time I went to a preview, it was Angels and Demons, and they projected that trailer off the video projector.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell what the movie was about.
Shocker.
It was unbelievably bad.
Particularly if you're trying to get people to come and see the movie and you're showing it.
So why do advertisers SD? Do it? I mean, why do advertisers...
It's just cheap, I guess. You know, they can cut it locally, put a, you know, local coming soon, local, you know, release date and everything on it here, I guess. And it's just, yeah, cheap.
I just, you know, I have a real problem with advertising agencies and their embracing of technology.
You too.
Yeah, really, I do. I do.
Absolutely. Look, you know, I'm still trying to battle to get, not from a Red fanboy point of view, I've said this before, but just trying to get them across the line that it's okay to not shoot film. I mean, the budgets are going south rapidly, and their expectations are not going with them. You know, they're still expecting, you know, I'm shooting something next week, and it's, you know, they've, in the middle of the production, they've decided, you know, I know we've all budgeted for 15 seconds, but won't 30 be cool? Can we do 30 second spots? And I'm going, of course, absolutely, these spots will be brilliant in 30. Let's do it. But I know, you know, for us, and for our budget, which is not really going to get compensated too much, it's going to, you know, this costs are going to get up. And if we'd shot on Red, that would not be an issue, or Genesis or whatever it be. So, you know, and so, yeah, definitely we need to slowly definitely have the same issue that you have with the agencies and technical expectations.
Well, I'm just appalled that they have multiple digital channels here, HD channels at that.
Yeah.
So I go to watch shows on digital HD delivery. All the commercials are provided standard def.
Yeah.
You cannot provide anything but a standard def commercial to them to get into their pipeline. So if you provide an HD tape, they go, thanks very much. We like getting HD tapes.
Yeah.
Dub it down to SD. Goes into the card machine.
Take this tape.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, you know, it's growing. Obviously, when we're having a stupid digital hand over here now, that's not going to be until like 2012
but
or something.
The other problem
ridiculous.
Is it's not even just that it's standard def, right? Because if it comes off a videotape, it's standard def where they got the 16:9-ness from shoving the image in horizontally, right? Mm. Like that was always my problem with the F900 cameras, is that they weren't actually 1920 by 1080 across.
Yeah, it was a 4.3 chip or whatever.
Twice. Two double 4.3 chips, yeah, exactly. And so here you go. You make this commercial. It's nice, pretty pictures, 1920 by 1080 HD. They want to down-res it to standard def, but they don't just stop at standard def. They then actually compress it horizontally so it's 4:3 aspect ratio.
Yeah.
And then we re-expand it, and then up-res it to HD.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's kind of crazy. I mean, it'd be great to start posting stuff in HD. I mean, probably the way processing and things goes now, it's probably
one of the reasons I'm sitting here with you now is because we opened a post house to post-produce all their spots in HD.
Yes, that's true.
And
that's true.
It didn't work.
Well ahead of your time. Too ahead of your time.
It didn't work. It would have worked better had they... Yeah, but anyway, it was... Yeah.
It was cool at the time. Wow, HD, awesome. But look... Yeah, but they're still pretty slow to adopt. If you start saying, oh, we want to shoot this, the only reason you'd want to shoot it in HD and post in HD at the moment is if you want to then go out to a really nice Kinney or do a really nice cinema finish.
Well, yeah, that would work really well.
But still then for broadcast, for on-air, it'd still be going to air standard def.
So. Standard def is so appallingly crappy.
It can look okay, but yeah, I mean, I know before I bought the Blu-ray player I've got, everyone was saying, don't bother. It's like 3% better. It's really not that much better. And, you know, for some DVDs, standard def DVDs, there isn't an awful lot in it, but some of them are just a cracker. I can understand why Blu-ray hasn't really kind of, boy, we're rat-holing now, hasn't really, you know, leapt off, you know, in terms of success, just because some DVDs, standard def DVDs are outstanding, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the other problem is that HD transmission is so bit depth.
Oh, that's the other thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Screwed down.
Yeah.
That you're not really getting a lot of HD advantage.
Yeah, it's only just HD, really. A lot of the HD transmissions. I'm only just starting to watch a little bit of it on one of our TVs, and it's a lot of time it's like 576p or whatever, or 720, only just 720p, and it's sort of come off a satellite from the Formula One in Dubai or whatever, and by the time it's kind of been bounced around a bit, it's pretty compressed, so there's not a lot of difference between that and a really good SD.
So why do we bother, Jace? Why do we bother?
I don't know, so that when it finally does, we'll know what we're doing, I suppose.
I used to finish the show reel in HD and go, shame no one will see it like this.
That would be good, actually. I'd love to start doing my reel in Blu-ray, but I know that no one's ever really going to... I'd be up-resing half the stuff for a start. But
we did all of Dwarf in HD, full
yeah,
HD
yeah,
finish.
No, that's awesome.
But that's a valuable asset moving forward.
Definitely. I mean, when you've shot it, it went to air HD in England?
No, the first airing was in standard def. I don't know if it's since aired in HD, but it was standard def because the Dave channel is a non-HD channel.
It's non-HD.
And obviously it was made for Dave. That was the primary thing. But the secondary market is it's an asset, you know, like a very valuable asset.
Oh, you'd have to do it forward-thinking.
So 10 years from now, you're going to want to put it on whatever channel is showing repeats of great shows from 10 years ago. And
and voila. It'll look better than the other ones, for sure.
Well, let's now go to the Red Room, if we can, Jace, and speak to First Lieutenant Tyler Ginter, who is the platoon leader of the 55th Combat Camera Company.
You're entering the Red Room.
Well, now live in the Red Room, we have First Lieutenant Tyler Ginter, platoon leader of the 55th Combat Camera Company. And thanks for joining us on the line. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike.
Hey, Tyler, you're our first live interview victim.
Wow. This is very cool. I'm honored to be here. I've been listening to Red Center for over a year now. I actually started listening when I was in Iraq. That's got me through some... Mike would put me to sleep once in a while, but that's only when we talked about bear patterns and things. So.
Well, look, I'm really
glad I've learned
to know that I was supporting
the troops
in helping... Yeah.
You guys totally did. No, you guys are awesome. So thanks for having me.
Okay, well, look, take us through the 55th Camera Company, what its role is, and your role within it, I guess.
Well, it's a great organization to be in. I'm actually very lucky to be in the Army and be in this organization at the same time. I'm a media production major, so I got a pinpoint assignment here, and I'm in charge of about 30-man team. When I was in Iraq, it was 22 in Iraq, and there's about another 11 in Afghanistan. And we deploy all around the world, supporting primarily combat documentation, but also humanitarian and different things going on around the military. What sets us apart from your normal photojournalists and video journalists downrange is we're specifically trained as soldiers still, soldiers first. So we carry weapons and we are prepared to use them if need be. So we can really augment and get into places where they're classified, in places that other organizations can't get into. So our imagery first goes into the on-the-ground commanders and the, internally, and then it branches out to the public when it gets released and cleared. So it's a great mission, and actually I might be heading out your way next month to Australia. There's a Talisman Sabre. It's a joint operation. We do a lot of those too. No. I would never invade Australia. No, it's we do that a lot. We were in the Philippines and Balikatan last month, and we go over and our joint environments, like we work with the Canadians and different armies around the world, because when I was in Iraq, we had plenty of Australian army there that work side by side with us in Baghdad. So it's it gives us an opportunity to train together and also teach each other different skills. It's pretty good stuff.
Well, look forward to seeing you out here then.
Can I ask you, is the primary brief to produce footage for the internal use of the armed services, or is it to produce material for the general public? Because, of course, people forget that there's an enormous requirement for, say, the army to produce material for the army.
Yes, and that's a great question. It's obviously, first and foremost, it's to serve the internal purpose. There's also in the military, it's called public affairs, and they write broadcast stories and do shows and all that stuff. We're the guys outside the wire getting the imagery. I kind of describe us as stock footage collectors, if you think about, And then, we shoot it out to all the other organizations internally into the military that do all the production and high-end stuff on that. And then, as it gets released to the next level, it does eventually leak out to the get out to the public. And then, historically, too, we serve a big purpose, because all the footage you see from World War II and past wars were from combat camera out there gathering it and historically archiving it. All of our stuff gets archived at the Pentagon. We have about a 12-hour turnaround time. Obviously, all this stuff comes back compressed first in H.264 format for HD. And it's about 720p. And then we'll actually later on get the uncompressed sent back, and whether it be dual layer DVD or Blu-ray or however we on a hard drive, and that stuff gets archived uncompressed as well. So,
because a lot of your stuff goes to AAP and Reuters and things,
once it gets out to the public, it goes on a site called DivitsHub.net, which you can actually anybody in the world can go and check it out right now, and then you can also get a free username, password, and download imagery, and it'll track who is using it and for what. But yeah, AP, Reuters, New York Times, all of the big big news organizations in both TV and print will pull our stuff for what they need it for. So
while that's a kind of a short term interest in one sense, there's also almost an archival documentarian nature to this, because of the importance of just actually documenting this for literally for generations to come.
Yes, and this is actually one of the, I would feel comfortable saying one of the biggest documented wars in history. I mean, there's so much imagery that's been collected. When we were in Iraq, in the 9 months we were there, we sent 26,000 photos and 45 hours of video that was transmitted to the Pentagon and archived historically. And so those, like I was saying, those numbers are actually captioned and virined imagery that it was properly tagged.
Right. So, yeah, a lot of your work and your assistant's work is actually tagging metadata and adding information to these photos. So, as you say, it's not just some random photo in the archives. Every photo has a backstory to it, I guess.
That's so important. I wrote a blog on that on my blog about metadata and how critical it is. And it's actually really easy with software like Lightroom today, where you actually can add that metadata as you import it. But also coming back and tweaking those captions, we require each caption to be unique, who, what, where, when, why. And that's, it really is something that might not seem that critical right now, but 15, 20 years down the line, and it's going to pay off. So,
All right. Well, talking about capture, things have obviously changed very drastically with you, with the equipment that you're implementing into the field. You're about to embark on a huge deployment of the Canon 5D, yeah?
Yes. So since I've been back for about 5 or 6 months now, and that's been the past 5 or 6 months has been, as well as my additional, you know, normal platoon duties, I'm still getting everybody back in the swing of things and getting back into more missions coming up that are local, stateside, and abroad. It's been a lot of research and development on these new kits. It's been a huge thing, huge goal of mine to upgrade this equipment to the right thing. And it's kind of funny because when I was in Iraq about the last 2 months I was there, Vincent LaFerrette's footage came out. And, you know, that alone was just, you know, it just sparked me to say, this might just be possible. It's been like 100 years ago. It was kind of a far reach at first, and then we started to look into the camera and test it. A lot of limitations. I've talked about this to so many people before. It really have to look at your workflow. Once you figure out your workflow, then you can make the determination if this camera is for you or not. Is it for filmmakers? Yes and no. I mean, doesn't have 24p. Doesn't have a lot of the things that you need. However, there's a lot of people building a lot of cool rigs and stuff for it too that'll allow you follow focus, map boxes, good audio, and with Beach Tech's new devices and stuff coming out. So it's really an interesting tool, and it fits into our workflow. And like I said, it's not going to fit into everybody's workflow, but it fits into our workflow, and so far it's been a big impact on how we've been testing it and using it so far.
But a piece of kit that can do two things must be an absolute godsend to you guys, where you've got to, like, you know, jump out of airplanes to sort of, you know, get into essentially you're shooting in war zones.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because you hear all this stuff on different shows and podcasts and things about this whole dual technology and how that's changing photojournalism and all this stuff. And it's interesting because the Army's been dual trained for at least 10 years now. I mean, it's been our job to both shoot both photo and video on a mission. And we're either taking two cameras out or we'll go on a two-man team and you designate who does what for that mission. And it's kind of a headache for us out in the field and for the soldiers, because you got two big kits, you got extra crap that you need out there, something breaks or something goes down. You know, it's nice to have, what our guys on our biggest feedback is, to have one camera, lightweight, compact, portable, and I mean, we all know it's an amazing photo camera. There's no doubt about it. I mean, what the 5D did to the industry in the first place, with the first full frame, affordable DSLR, and just adding video mode that actually kind of works if you use it right and you learn how to work around it. And actually now, I mean, I guess we can all say safe and sound that there's new firmware that just came out yesterday.
So. Yeah.
That makes it even more interesting for us, because we probably should put in the show notes, but there's a Dan Fung Dennis. He's a freelancer. He's worked with a bunch of organizations like New York Times and all kinds of stuff, but he was in Afghanistan. We've been talking back and forth offline about some of these kit things and how we're going to use it, and it was really cool. So he had this for 4 months in Afghanistan. I use a lot of his justification towards our justification for the kit. And I mean, you just imagine that. If you look at his footage, he's going into rooms, pitch black rooms, with nothing else illuminating that room but a flashlight on somebody else's weapon. And he's getting really nice shots out of it. I mean, you're talking about shooting with a 1.2 lens at a full frame 35 sensor. And you just can't do that with any other camera for that price and that size. And that's a huge deal for us. I mean, a lot of people talk about the depth of field, which is great. That's a cinematic technique that is great to have. It's awesome. But to me, the most intriguing thing is the ability to have this low light performance and not have to use that ugly green vignetted night vision that we've been plagued with for so many years.
Yeah, I mean, remember there's some footage you showed me of just soldiers walking through a street, literally just lit by like one sodium vapor light, and it just looks like day. It's just amazing. The no light performance of this camera must just be a godsend.
I can take an 85 1.2 under candlelight and shoot ISO 300. And have perfectly enough exposure to get by, and that is the incredible thing about this camera that's really impressed me more than anything else. And yes, the 30p 24p it is an issue. It's been made clear. Canon and Nikon, these other well, Nikon already obviously has that, but I think you know, more than anything, Canon's ability to you know, look at the solution for the manual control and adapt to that, whether or not you can, you know, accept that it doesn't shoot 24p, at least knowing that, you know, this camera has, it has changed a lot of things in this industry, in my opinion. I think it's really pushing other cameras to perform and do better. We're pretty much guaranteed that whatever Nikon comes out with next has to have manual control to compete. It has to. And that's what Canon just did. They didn't have to do that. You know, they were selling, I'm sure, plenty of cameras before this whole firmware thing came out, and they turned around, released it, and I think really pushing the limits. It's great. I love competition.
We love it too. I've got a question for you though. I'm just curious as to what the lens kit is that you would have, because, you know, obviously the lightweight thing is related to also just what you have to lug along with the camera. So let's say you're going out and doing some work in the field. What would be a typical camera kit? Just run us through the bits in the kit.
I have some stuff that I gave to Jason. Hopefully you guys can show some of that I actually researched and picked out for the standard kit. So I have a standard kit, which is consists of the 5D Mark II plus a backup body, and the kit lens, a 24-105. And yes, that's an f/4. There's a couple reasons behind that. And coming into the way we have to document, it's a little different than having full follow focus rigs all the time and being able to pull focus when you're running through a street and stuff. So actually the f/4 and having the ability now to actually control your aperture and bump it up if you need to kind of lower the field, it allows you to focus more on the composition than having to pull focus. That compared with the range of that lens is actually pretty nice for us. So 24-105 goes from pretty wide to about as far as you want to get before you're going to start to see some skew and jello in the footage before, you know, you zoom with your feet anyway. So back to the fundamentals. Then we'll also in each kit have the 51.4, and that obviously will be our, you know, nice lens for low light and different things like that. Then we have the fun kit, the advanced kit in each platoon that goes out there, and that's going to have all the cool toys, the 7200, the 85 1.2, the 16-35 2.8, the, you know, all the tilt shift, the macro, the different lenses for different things. So, you know, our bread and butter lenses are pretty standard, but then, you know, we get in the advanced for certain missions that you can pick and pull what you need.
You also got the Steadicam Merlin in that kit. That must be pretty cool.
Yes, we do. I actually have some stuff online. I got a 101 class NAB from Garrett Brown. That was actually pretty cool. So he helped me rig it up a little bit better than I had done. And that guy's a genius. What he's done to this community is amazing. So, you know, he helped me rig it up, and it works pretty good on this. Another lightweight piece you can add. And I mean, for some missions, it's a little too much. But for street patrols and for humanitarian stuff, you put that on there, and your production value just goes up that much more. Yeah. And it's really interesting because, I mean, the military, for the way we operate, we've just never been able to get away with this kind of stuff. You just can't. And now we're starting to do it, and it's really cool. I think we're going to start pushing the bar to stuff places we haven't been before, which excites me.
Yeah, well, when you're talking about shooting full frame 35, essentially motion picture kind of look, and it'll have mini steady cams with you, and, you know, this is, you guys are shooting movies now.
The combat zone. Yeah. And this is uncontrolled action. It's a big difference from shooting, and I used to shoot sports, and even that was uncontrolled action, but you still kind of knew, like in a controlled set, like if you're shooting baseball, you know, like the runner's going to go from first base to second base. And if you're pulling focus, you know how you kind of have things set in mind. But when you get out there and it gets out of control, you know, it's a little bit of a different game than saying cut and let's retake that last one, you know. So it's a little bit of a different experience. But having, you know, small, compact things and items in this kit is really going to allow us to take it to that level that we want to. And, you know, this is version one. I mean, that's the exciting thing. And I don't want to just talk about the 5D Mark II. I mean, look at the GH1, and that's going to come out, let's say, about the next month, I think, early next month.
Yeah. Well, talking about things getting out of control, You sent me an amazing story from one of your guys,
yes.
who literally, as you said, you guys are trained as soldiers first, and he literally had to do that, had to, in the middle of what was a firefight. I mean, you can tell the story, but essentially had to down camera and went in and saved his buddies and definitely put the soldier hat on well and truly and got himself a Silver Star.
Silver Star is actually the third highest military award that you can get. And it was honored by special forces who we worked with there. And that's a huge, huge thing. I'm very proud of this guy. He got to work with him once we got back. And excellent, excellent soldier. Just, you know, very modest. Obviously doesn't talk much about this. So I would actually like everybody to check out the article if you have time. And check out some of his photos that are in there too. But he weapon trained for combat, and combat is expected. We go places they don't allow photojournalists to go. And so when we're, you know, when we get into a firefight, we drop our camera and pick up our weapon. And I mean, that's what we sign up for the Army to do. And this guy actually had his camera shot. A bullet went through his camera, back through his Camelback, which is like a water pouch in his back. And he actually helped rescue several special forces soldiers by helping them get down. They were surrounded by the Taliban in the mountains from all angles. And it was, you know, I don't want to tell it. It's not my story, but I'm extremely proud of this guy. And he's, you know, that's what combat camera is to me.
It's a very moving story, I must admit. And you know, he's full of humility, though I was myself touched when reading it, how it was just the admiration of the Green Berets that meant almost as much to him as anything. I'm
that's
curious.
That's the challenge. And you got, and this guy's a specialist in E4. And I have I took a lot of specialists in E4s and PFCs, and they're lower ranking guys in the normal traditional Army, but in combat camera, these guys are freaking heroes. To integrate with a team the way they do, as a one or two man team, and to walk up to a completely organic organization and say, "Hey, you know, this is what I can offer you. You know, give me a chance. I know what to do. I know what you do." They build that trust, they build a relationship, and that bond that you don't get anywhere else. And that's, you know, that's the cool thing about our job. And then the other cool thing is we can always provide somebody a product in the end. So it's, you know, they always like taking photos and stuff like that. But it's really about how we can integrate with the team and help the warfighter the best we can.
Can I ask you a question? Because I want to stay away from the particular story of what happened there with Special Forces, because that obviously is an incredible story in its own right. But in the general day-to-day running, what is the relationship between those on the ground that are, say, I'm going to pick a thing out of the air here, doing a door-to-door search, and their relationship between those actual guys and women on the ground and your team? Are they seeing the role that the camera unit is doing as being important? Are they seeing it as something that they just have to sort of put up with? I mean, what's the relationship? I'm just curious to...
Yeah, and that's it all comes back to how we train our guys. And, you know, it's how you sell combat camera, because if you just show up with your camera and look all jacked up, then you're going to be jacked up and they're not going to accept you. But if you show up and you say, "This is what I can provide you, this is how I'm going to support you in intel and in, you know, in combat documentation and all this other stuff," then it does take time. They still look at you. Some people, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, they definitely know combat camera is getting better. But, you know, in different locations, they might look at combat camera as a liability, or, you know, you're another photojournalist, or who's the camera guy. But, that's just the perception from what the media has done. And, you know, they not that they're scared of a camera, they just, you know, it's that extra thing that they got to look out for. But it only takes us a mission or a few days to, like I said, integrate. Show them what we can do, show them what we have done, and provide them a product. And then they'll take us right in. They'll never want to lose us. I mean, they could have taken more combat camera pretty much every location. The problem is we are such a small organization. We have about 222 in the company. We're the only active duty Army combat camera company. So Air Force and Navy and Marines also have their own combat camera, but they're all small as well. So, you know, it's kind of us getting out there And that's actually kind of my next job in the unit after I actually it's coming up soon. I'm going to go my platoon that I deployed with and start up, take the best guys from this platoon, start up the first ever training platoon. And that's really to get them honed in on their technical and tactical skills. We're going to have advanced training platoon to teach them all this advanced kit with the mat box and the follow folks, city cams and all that stuff. But really, really the important part besides the tactical pieces, the operational sense behind it of how do you approach complete strangers that you haven't met before as a one man or two man young soldier and prove to them that, you know, you need to be on that mission. So,
and if I can ask you the mirror question of that, we obviously want our troops, or, you know, in our case, our troops serve with your troops, but we want the troops to be well funded and well looked after in terms of equipment. So a question to you, I guess, is what do you see as the Army's position versus, you know, support of the unit?
As in the Army as a bigger picture, as in how they look it down, look upon.
Yeah,
us.
I mean, is it seen as being a really important part of the effort, and thus you feel
yes.
really, really well supported, or do you feel like the unit could always benefit from more attention?
No, we are extremely well supported, and especially when we deploy General Petraeus, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. When we were in Iraq, it was a huge support coming from higher on our mission. Public affairs too. The whole imagery thing is critically important to strategic communication. And in order to better inform the populace, it takes, as you get down to the lower levels, they might not understand the importance as much. But our imagery, as it goes up through the chain, is touching. Some of the stuff ends up on the president's desk for review. It goes to the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. It gets to where it needs to be. And like I said before, there's, you know, not everybody can get that kind of imagery the way that we can get it. So that's the important part about it.
Yeah, because it's not really this Hollywood view, you know, of like the generals sitting in the Pentagon all looking on 55 different monitors all hooked up to soldiers' headgear. It's just the reality just isn't that. So you guys are a real link from, you know, to right to the top, I guess.
Yeah, in order to transmit in Iraq, we had a BGAN, a broadband global area network, little laptop size satellite dish. Cost $5 a megabyte to transmit imagery. And so you're stuck out in Basra or in some remote location, and you figure we're sending compressed video at around 10,000 kilobits per second, which is about 500 megs or so for 5 minutes. So 500 megs times $5 a megabyte adds up pretty quick. And so that's the reality. I mean, but our imagery is that important that some of that stuff has to be pushed over that kind of bandwidth to get it in time for, you know, what they need to use it for and see. So, yeah, it's good as quality possibly can get. But a lot of stuff is also used for recon and intel and things like that. So, you know, they're just trying to pick and pull what they need for the mission.
So let me ask you this. We've discussed a bit about the cameras and the setup, obviously, for shooting with the cameras. But equally important is, picking and culling that down to the key footage. And in terms of video workflow, the stuff that's coming off these cameras, how are you actually editing them? How are you putting them together? What's the package that supports the cameras?
The new kits or the current
kits
packing to make interesting? So we're kind of in a technological gap. We have some Panasonic Toughbooks, which was the old decision before I came in and kind of moved it to where it needs to be. So currently we're struggling editing the 5D Mark II footage on these Toughbooks. We're kind of using MPEG stream clip, and that's about it. Our guys know how to shoot in the camera, which is obviously the most important thing. Edit in the camera. The cool thing about the 5D Mark II is you can go back and delete the clips in the camera. So you can do a lot of your workflow as you're coming back from a mission. So when you get back, you drag and drop. We require a 3 to 5 minute stringer from each mission. So it's basically prime cuts. The purpose of that is anything that we shoot. So you have your 3 to 5 minute stringers, basically B-roll and some interviews tacked on the end, can be brought together in any kind of story can be broadcasted from it if need be. So that's our intent. Our intent is to come back, edit it down to a 3 to 5 minute prime cuts, no transitions, nothing fancy, slate on the front, captions embedded in the metadata, and shoot that stuff off and let somebody else handle it so we can go on another mission. Now, in the new kit, we have MacBook Pros and Final Cut, which is a dream to edit with. So with the 5D Mark II footage, and obviously when Leopard comes out, there's some rumors that might even get better with the native H.264 real-time editing. But even with this, I can take a Extreme FireWire 800 compact flash card reader with these Extreme 4 compact flash cards, edit straight off the card, which isn't recommended, but if need be, you can edit this stuff right off the card, not even have to drag and drop it to your desktop, and you know, cut together what you need to and export it out in compressor. And you know, like I said, that compressed version anywhere between 5,000 to 10,000 kilobits per second, which is the in low bandwidth situations, and then eventually we'll get out the uncompressed later. But the news organizations so far have been pretty happy because, I mean, you got to figure, not everybody's getting this kind of imagery that fast, and they'll take what they can get. And 1080p at 10,000 kilobits per second is still pretty damn good. So,
yeah. So your guys, in the field are essentially acting like edit assistants, I suppose, prepping raw package ready for news organizations to then cut into a story. Okay.
Exactly. Have somebody else ready, and that's just, you know, whether it's being used to review or whether it's being pushed out to the public, it's always going to be ready. We do our job, and then we push it off to the person that wants to do it next. And then when we're back here at the unit and we go on different missions, then we start to put together productions and stuff like that. But we're downrange. It's because we said there's a limited people with this kind of knowledge and experience to go out and do this kind of stuff. So why waste your time spending 2 or 3 days putting together a post-production feature when you could be out gathering more imagery? And that's our whole goal of a combat camera.
Yeah, and yeah, they're not about altering the images, as you say. Did give it raw, no transitions. It's all about sort of capturing as it happens and letting somebody else put the edit or the spin on it, so to speak.
Absolutely. That's you just hit it right on the head. It's one of the big things that we tell people when we come up with, we're not here to write a story about you. We're here to document what's going on, and combat camera does not make up twist. They don't do any of that stuff. We shoot and we send it off, and you know, after that it says what happened historically, and you know what people do with it after that is, you know, out of our control. We make sure that our stuff is as accurate as humanly possible.
So I just jump back a little bit to the laptop situation. I remember you telling me that you moved away from the Panasonic Toughbooks because they just ain't.
They're not tough. Sorry, Panasonic, but yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, we realized that 90% of the laptops that broke were breaking from transportation. So if you have it in a rucksack and it's been, you know, in a sling load or it's dragged around or dropped or whatever, it's breaking from point A to point B. So instead of trying to get a laptop that's all bulky and tough with low processor, we get a high speed laptop. And Pelican makes these Pelican cases, and you can see if you post the kit,
yeah,
it'll actually great. It's waterproof, fireproof. I don't know if it's fireproof, but it's waterproof and dustproof, and it's crush proof, and it allows you to, you know, the great thing about the Mac is you can, you know, with this Pelican case combination, is you can just put it together, go out and open it up when you need to, and you got your little Mac there ready to rock and edit what you need to. So definitely going to be a big improvement in our kit along with this camera. Everything in this new kit is compacting down. I mean, compared to what we'd had, and we're saving the Army money, which is a crazy thing. Instead of buying, you know, two cameras and two night vision systems and two of all these other pieces, we're buying one with a backup, and all the components are the same, and then the training's the same. And for us, that's a dream. I don't have to train you on two separate cameras and then another backup camera that's completely different. And it might sound small, but when you have 200 some soldiers, it's, you know, as you upgrade equipment, you want to make it as seamless as possible. So that's a big impact on us. One button pushing and swapping between video and photo, it's pretty cool.
Well, no disrespect to your students, but obviously training 200 people to use some pretty technical gear and also be a journalist and edit and transmit, and, you know, it can't be easy.
No, it's a lot of work, but, you know, you have to have a certain ASVAB score, which is your test score when you get in, and you have to have certain recommendations. I mean, it's not we have some of the smartest soldiers, I feel, in the Army, in our unit, and they're willing to learn and be adaptable and overcome this stuff. And it just takes time. And, you know, what helps more than anything is these video tutorials. The same reason why, you know, I'm an FX PhD grad and postgrad, and that's how I learn. I learn from watching video tutorials of things, workflows. And I try to, you know, one of my big points I'm teaching to the other services and the other, not just combat camera, but VI, visual information, which is VI in general, which is across the board, is, you know, the best way to train these soldiers and these airmen and different services up is teach them a workflow. Don't just try and throw them on Lynda and, you know, here's a Final Cut class that, you know, teaches you all this stuff. I mean, we are in a point where there's so much to learn. We got to streamline it from point A to point B, what you need to do. And if you can put all that together in a video tutorial, in the past we were because I built this whole smart book and it has all this stuff that you need. Give them somebody a CD and DVD, they can sit down and watch it, and they learn how to do everything from point A to point B. And that's, you know, that's my learning technique, and I see it having a huge impact as we're changing this equipment over.
Yeah, as you say, having one piece of kit is really going to streamline things.
You know, it's quite humbling that you guys, you know, use our training and stuff, because I would be remiss if we spoke to you and we didn't point out that, you know, sometimes people have opinions on policy of governments, but there is not anyone I know that doesn't think that you guys are doing an amazing job, and we really owe you a huge debt of gratitude. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I do appreciate it.
And we're going to say at this point, we're going to thank you for being on the show, and hopefully we can touch base with you again sometime in the future. But it really has been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you very much. And I want to thank presumably the Army, who's given you permission to talk to us, because we, you know, I think the kind of openness that you exhibit in terms of explaining how you work and do things, that the more people understand what's going on, I think the better it is. But in your case, it's also fascinating to hear your experiences. So thank you.
No problem. There's a lot of things I didn't talk about, which I can't talk about, but there's a lot of other cool things we do as well. But I hope that gave you a little bit of knowledge, and you know, always, as you know, as Stu Maskowitz says, go out and shoot something. These cameras, and I'm really excited about this, because I could say in the next 2 years, cameras are going to become kind of like what we have with hardware for audio. We're at a point where it's so cheap, and everything you get, if you get like an audio for like the Zoom H4N, you're going to get everything you need in that package. There's not going to be any limitations. And I think we are on a cutting break. And as long as these camera companies keep pushing each other, it's just going to keep getting better for everybody. So, let's hopefully, you know, we'll see some cool stuff out there in the future, and we'll be using it.
Awesome. We'll keep in touch as that rolls out.
Yep. You guys have a great one. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tyler.
So we're going to have some of that in the show notes, Jace?
Yep, definitely. All of the links that we've talked about for that we'll have in the show notes, and links to Tyler's blog, his Vimeo page, tons
you know,
of
I might,
stuff.
I might do a special page on FX Guide for this, because I think it's kind of worth it.
Yeah, there's so much footage out there, and particularly with the 5D as well, there's a lot of other stuff out there. Particularly he was talking about Dan Fung Dennis's, I think he's got a blog page, but there's certainly some links to footage he's done, which is really, because the 5D is only just being implemented, now by Tyler and the 55th company, Dan Fung Dennis is one of the first people to actually really get in there, and he's actually a journalist, not a soldier, to be actually right in there kicking in doors and being right behind the guys on the front line.
He's so not a soldier, but he's still kicking in doors. Is that elite?
He's right behind the guys kicking in the doors.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Just in case the guy on the other side of the door has a rocket launcher.
Right. I mean, yeah.
So
until...
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's been great talking to Tyler. Really enjoyed that. And
yeah, thanks, mate.
And in fact, enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. Same here. So for more rat holes, join us next week on Red Center. Mike, where can we find you?
I'm on the Twitters as Mike Seymour, and obviously over at fxguide.com and fxphd.com.
And my website, jasonwingrove.com and twitter.com/Wingrove for me on the Twitter. Thanks again, Mike, and we'll... catch you all next week.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright. copyright 2009, FX Guide, LLC.